from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, the history of monogamy and what science tells us about the true nature of human sexuality. A recent book challenges conventional wisdom about mating and marriage, tracing the prehistoric origins of modern sexuality to explain why people have so much trouble sticking with just one sexual partner. This hour, we'll talk with a co-author of Sex at Dawn, and of course, we want to hear from all of you as well. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome once again to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. This hour, we're talking about one of the most fundamental aspects of human nature, sexuality. We're told that fidelity, love, and marriage are inseparable, or should be. But if we humans are really a monogamous species, why is long-term monogamy so difficult for so many couples? Those questions and many others are explored in the book Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. We're joined now by psychologist and author Christopher Ryan, who co-wrote the book with his wife, Casilda Jetta. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Scott.
In the introduction to the book, you write, "We need a new assessment of ourselves based not on pulpit proclamations or Hollywood fantasies, but on a bold assessment of scientific data that illuminate the true origins and nature of human sexuality." So what do the data tell us?
They tell us that our ancestors evolved in a social setting in which sexuality was shared, much the way everything else was shared. Food, shelter, protection from predators, childcare, all these things are shared in hunter-gatherer societies like those in which our ancestors evolved. If you look, we look at four different sources of data, essentially, in the book. We look at hunter-gatherer societies who live more or less the way our ancestors presumably lived. We look at the human body, which is full of information, indications of the way our ancestors interacted sexually. We look at contemporary psychosexuality, research that shows what sort of pornography people are into, what sorts of problems drive people to marriage counselors and so on. And we also look at primatology, those primates that are most closely related to human beings, particularly chimpanzees and bonobos.
And you say that the really prehistoric men and women had more of a free-floating sense of sexuality. It was more, if you would, promiscuous.
Yeah.
And what was the reason for that?
Well, the reason is that, you know, the reason our ancestors survived and flourished is that our species is particularly good at forming complex social networks. That's what we do better than anyone else. And if you look at highly social, highly intelligent primates, virtually all of them practice what's known as a multi-male, multi-female mating system, which we can call promiscuous. But it's important to understand that we use promiscuous in the original sense of the word, which is just to mix. There's no moral judgment, and we're certainly not suggesting that our ancestors were having uncaring sexual relationships, because they knew each other very well. They raised each other's children. The women breastfed one another's children. The men hunted together, protected each other and one another's. What's interesting is that pre-agricultural people have very little sense of private property. And the modern sense of marriage and the nuclear family and so on is based upon a notion of private property that really only developed 10,000 years ago at the earliest, which is very recent in terms of evolution.
And you alluded to it a moment ago, the sort of the change in our culture or societies where people organized around agricultural communities really created a shift. Explain how that worked.
Well, it created a shift in virtually every aspect of human life. Our diet changed radically. The kinds of diseases people were dealing with changed radically. Health issues became a much larger problem. In fact, people think that agriculture was this boon to humanity. In fact, what you find is that our health decreased, our longevity decreased, the amount of violence people were dealing with both between societies and within a society increased dramatically. The status of women in society plummeted from parity with males to essentially becoming property. You know, you read Thou Shalt Not Covet Thy Neighbor's Wife, and it seems like it's about respecting another person's marriage. But when you read it in context, it's nor his house, nor his ox, nor his slaves. You know, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's property is really what that line is about. And so that gives us a bit of an insight into the way life was after the advent of agriculture.
And so was that change in sexual attitudes and behavior, how rapid was it?
Well, different pace at different parts of the world. Agriculture developed independently in different parts of the world. And it's difficult to say how it affected sexuality in terms of, you know, whether it was 100 years or 1,000 years. But we can certainly see from skeletal remains that the health effects were very rapid within a couple of generations. We see, for example, in the Fertile Crescent, the average male skeleton went from about 5'7", 5'8", to 5'2", 5'3", in just a few generations. Just one indication of how radically diminished the nutritional situation was.
And you say that, you know, before that, there was more promiscuity, more sharing of sexual partners with no shame, no moral judgment. How quickly did that change? And wasn't there a, you know, what was that transition like?
I think we can safely say the transition was pretty horrible. In fact, in Sex at Dawn, Casilda and I reframe the telling of the expulsion from the Garden of Eden and the fall, original sin. All these things to us pretty clearly seem to be retelling of the shift from hunter-gatherer life to an agricultural life, where the world changed from a place that provided, where pleasure and happiness and effortless existence was the norm, to a world in which food had to be won with the sweat of your brow, and the gods became jealous and angry, and you know, a very different kind of world than the one in which our ancestors enjoyed.
So fast forward to the 20th century, the 21st century, where we are today. Rates of marriage are declining. Rates of divorce are going up. There's a whole debate about the future of marriage. What do you think, from the data, the biology, the evolution, the science, how does that explain those trends?
Well, what's happening is that we are butting up against our biology, right? We're caught in this conflict between what our biology demands of us and what our society demands of us. And we're all victims of this conflict. And that one of the things we try to really explain clearly in the book is that there is no war between the sexes. This framing of human evolution is men and women want two very different things, and therefore we're constantly at battle with one another. That's not really true if you look at it from the perspective we present in the book. In fact, we're in this together, and we're victims together of this conflict between society and biology.
Meaning that men and women equally are interested in having sex outside of their primary relationship.
Yes. We evolved as omnivores. Every bit we could say we're sexual omnivores every bit as much as we're dietary omnivores. Now, the book is not an argument against monogamy. Let's get that out on the table right away. It's not advocating anything. But what we're saying is, look, this is the kind of species we are. It's very clear. If you look at the data we present in the book, it's very clear that we evolved in this context, that these are our natural predilections. If you're going to stray from that, if you're going to design your life in a way that's in conflict with that, that can be fine. Just like vegetarianism, it can be ethical, it can be healthy, it can be economical, it can be a great decision in many ways. But just because you've decided to be a vegetarian doesn't mean bacon suddenly stops smelling good. So it's the similar situation with sexuality. You can choose to how to behave, but you can't choose what to feel.
The implication is that if we were to just give in to our nature and have sex with more partners with the, I guess, the approval or the acknowledgement of your partner, that we'd be better off, we'd be healthier, that our relationships would be healthier. But what about the psychology of that? I mean, you're a psychologist. I mean, it's very difficult to transcend things like jealousy and, you know, fear of being abandoned, all those things.
Sure, sure. And as I say, we're not advocating any – we're not advocating open marriages or swinging or anything else. But the only thing we're advocating in the book is authenticity and self-knowledge and, you know, to thine own self be true. That's where it
– That sounds like an advocation. You're advocating, you know, almost promiscuity without maybe take away the shame and the judgment about it. But, you know, just, hey, let's just be who we are.
Let's acknowledge who we are and let's begin from that perspective, from that position. And then if you and your partner or you before you even have a partner decide, look, I'm not monogamous and I don't want to live a life that's a lie, then fine. Get that out on the table from the beginning. If, on the other hand, you say, I live in this society that demands a certain sort of behavior and I'm a politician, let's say, not that there are many monogamous politicians, and you choose to live that way, fine. But acknowledge that there are going to be a lot of temptations. You're going to feel these things. The fact that you and your partner feel temptation isn't an indictment of your marriage.
You talk about politicians and other cultures, other countries, and I'm thinking particularly the French, seem to have a very different attitude both personally and also about their politicians.
Right.
François Mitterrand very very famously had an affair and a child with another woman. I think she came to his funeral. I mean, it was not a big deal. Why is it – what is it about our country that seems to have a much different attitude, and how different are we? Are we the norm? Are we the exception? How does it break down?
Well, behaviorally, I don't think Americans are much different from anyone else. You know, we're all drawn into the current of our biology, and some of us are better at resisting it than others. Where Americans differ from most European societies, I think, is in the sort of judgmental attitude and, frankly, the sort of adolescent attitude toward sexuality that we have in this country, where we're fascinated by it, but we pretend we're not. There's a lot of denial and shame involved. I guess that goes back to the, you know, the gift of the British, the Puritan approach to these matters.
You know, I was surprised at how little there was in the book about religion. Very little. Was that a conscious choice?
Well, we really only got into religion in terms of what I mentioned earlier with reframing the fall and original sin and that sort of thing. You know, the book's already long enough. Our editor, it was quite a bit longer when we sent in the manuscript. So getting into religion, you know, religion isn't – well, there's plenty of meat in the book as it is. There's plenty to offend any reader. But, you know, religion isn't something you take up lightly, especially if you're going to have a sort of unconventional discussion.
But so, I imagine you've been attacked by religious organizations.
Not as much as we expected, actually. In fact, I can't think of a single religious organization that's publicly attacked us. But, you know, I think we're at a moment in American society in which I think we're at a tipping point. I think the sorts of reactionary right-wing attack sources of those attacks are on their heels. You know, the Catholic Church certainly isn't going to make any grand pronouncements about their wisdom in terms of sexuality, given what's been going on there. And, you know, every week there's another televangelist,
scandal.
You know. And yeah. So it just seems that hypocrisy is so widely understood and assumed now that a lot of the people who would have been very critical, I think, are afraid to say anything.
Christopher Ryan, he is co-author, along with his wife, Casilda Jetta, of Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. It's available now in paperback. By the way, you will be on a panel tonight in San Francisco at the Supper Club. For more information, you can go to clubexoticapresents.com and talking about all of this. We'd love to hear from our listeners, of course. We're going to open the phone lines a little early. 866-733-6786 is the number if you want to weigh in on this. 866-733-6786 or email us. It's forum@kqed.org. What do you think? Is monogamy optional? Should it be? What kind of rules do you have in your relationship? What kind of rules could you live with? Let me ask you, there's the old Sinatra song, Love and Marriage Go Together Like a Horse and Carriage. Can't have one without the other. What do you think opening up relationships, what's the evidence of how it changes marital relationships or other kinds of primary relationships?
Well, in Western society, you find that the studies that I'm aware of have found that people in open marriages or in swinging situations report higher satisfaction with their relationships than the general public.
Both partners?
Yeah. And that could be, I wouldn't assume that opening a marriage is going to make it happier. But people who have open marriages tend to have a much higher level of communication. You know, conventional marriages, there are a lot of things that we just don't talk about, you know, whereas in an open marriage. Or we lie about, exactly, even worse. I think you were talking about European marriages earlier. I think in European marriages, there's a lot of a don't ask, don't tell sort of assumed in marriage in Europe, whereas in the States, you know, the Oprah-fied culture, everything has to be talked about.
Confessions.
Which means either lies in many cases or confessions that lead to divorce. And there's a book called Lust in Translation that Pamela Druckerman that looks at these different cultural traditions. And she talks about the American script. And the American script is that if one partner's had an affair, that's it. Marriage is over. Divorce. Call the lawyers. Whereas in Europe, first of all, it probably wouldn't even be discussed. And if it came up because someone, you know, a common friend saw you out with someone, there's not the assumption you're going to get divorced.
I know you're not advocating one thing or the other, but, you know, there is a question of trust that
right.
comes up.
Sure.
And, you know, if you choose to open it up with some kind of broad understanding or vague understanding and you don't talk about it, what are the consequences of that?
Well, that's the thing. Is it understood you're not going to talk about it, as in many of these European marriages, or is the assumption that you will talk about it and then you didn't, in which case you've betrayed a level of trust? Dan Savage talks about monogamous relationships, which, you know, his point is, look, people assume that a marriage is either open or closed. And if it's open, it means anything goes. It's crazy orgy weekend every week. Whereas, you know, what he's saying is, look, His relationship is generally monogamous, but with the occasional exception. Having grown up in central Pennsylvania, I'm not real comfortable with the term monogamish. It sounds too much like the Amish. Exactly. But I'll work with it. So they're all different variations. There are lots of shades of gray between, you know, your swinger couple that go to the conference in Vegas and the absolutely monogamous couple.
We have some email here from a listener who writes, I'd appreciate it if the speaker would address the fact that, is it bonobos?
Bonobos
are an endangered species and how therefore the move to monogamy as a human social norm might have a good evolutionary strategy. Tell us a little bit about the bonobos and what you found.
Bonobos are very important. You know, when you read in mainstream media, you read about the primate origins of human violence or of this or that, whatever. Chimps are always mentioned. And bonobos are very rarely mentioned. And that's a shame because bonobos are equidistant from humans.
On the evolutionary chain.
Exactly. Chimps and bonobos are exactly the same amount of shared DNA with humans, same last common ancestor. So they're equally relevant to any discussion of primate origins.
Are they as cute as chimps?
They're cuter. They're quite a bit cuter, and only visually cuter and behaviorally much cuter. if you throw some food into an enclosure of chimps, chaos breaks out. And they're very hierarchical, male-dominated species. If you throw food into an enclosure of bonobos, they'll have sex with one another and then share the food. Chimps, that we've seen warfare, we've seen infanticide, murder, rape, all sorts of nastiness. In over four decades of observing bonobos in the wild and in captivity, there has not been a single case of infanticide, murder, rape, or warfare between groups. They're incredibly peaceful. Franz Duval, the great primatologist, wrote that chimps use violence to get sex, and bonobos use sex to avoid violence. Hmm. So any discussion of human origins, it's very important to balance the discussion with both bonobos and chimps.
All right, let's go to the phones. We have a lot of folks wanting to weigh in, as you might imagine. Give us a call again, 866-733-6786. Let's go first to Oakland. Larry is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. I really appreciate the show. The book has been the topic of conversation in my community for many weeks now. One of the things I wanted to say was that my partner and I have been non-monogamous for about 10 years now. The most important thing we found is it has increased our level of communication. We actually have to be emotionally honest with each other. And in expressing your desire about another person has been, to start with, very challenging. There were issues of jealousy and fear. But when we realized that our relationship and our love to each other was not the defining point in our relationship to other people. We've had a very successful and wonderful marriage. We've been through all kinds of things and managed to survive in a way that I have not seen most other couples do.
Did it begin that way?
No, actually, well, she was not monogamous when I met her. And I think primarily out of my socialized male fears, I was like, no, I can't do that. And then we had a friend who introduced us, shall we say, to the non-monogamous lifestyle. And we prefer poly, actually, is the term we use.
Polyamorous, or?
Yes. And it's, you know, it is the concept that you can have loving relationships with more than one person without threatening that primary relationship.
Yeah.
I know many people have been doing it for 30-plus years.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if you have kids or think you might want to have kids.
I have a child from a previous marriage, and we do not and did not plan on having children because we're both, she's in her late 30s and I'm in my late 40s. But I know many people who do. I have friends of ours who've been poly-educated for many years are now planning on having a child.
Hmm. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
How open are you with your family, your friends, coworkers?
It depends on who it is. There's so much judgment out there, especially towards my partner because she's female. There's that societal proprietary thing that society views women in still many ways as chattel. And for her to say, it's the slut angel thing. Is for me, I'm a big old stud because I have more than one person.
Yeah.
She is a whore. And, that judgment keeps us often from being more open with people. We're not open with our family. Mine, very conservative. Hers.
Yeah. Christopher Ryan, there is obviously a double standard for men and women. And I'm wondering, do you find that women are more resistant to this than men?
No, not to the book, certainly. We've received so many emails from women who feel validated and vindicated by the narrative of human sexual evolution we present in Sex at Dawn, primarily because one of the things that we point out in the book is that women are every bit as sexual as men, have every bit as much libido. It's different. It expresses itself in different ways. It's shaped differently by social environments. But when you look at societies in which women are not shamed, they have just as many lovers as men do, and they're just as vehement as men are about their rights.
Christopher Ryan, the co-author of the book Sex at Dawn. We'll have much more with him in the rest of the hour, and you can join us. Call us at 866-733-6786 or email us. It's forum@kqed.org. You can also post a comment or question on our website, kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page as well. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. This hour, we're talking about the biology of monogamy with Christopher Ryan. He and his wife, Casilda Jetta, have written the book Sex at Dawn, The Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality. We'd love to have you join us this morning, 866-733-6786, or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Here's an email from Neil, who writes, when talking about a person who is deciding whether to be monogamous, the guest used the phrase, I don't want to live a lie. And he says he's not advocating something. Calling monogamous lifestyle a lie sure seems to be advocating one side over another. What's your reaction to that?
It's only a lie if you're lying, right? If someone chooses to be monogamous and they actually are monogamous, then there's no lie involved.
But choose to be monogamous.
Sure. But a lot of people enter into a monogamous sort of ostensibly monogamous situation already knowing in their hearts that they're not going to be monogamous over the long haul and just assuming that they'll get away with it. And, you know, we see this reflected in popular culture everywhere we look. So that's when it's a lie. But, you know, as I say, we really aren't advocating anything other than self-knowledge. You know, understand what sort of animal you are and you'll make better choices, more informed choices, and get things out on the table. Talk about them. A lot of people are afraid to talk about these issues. We got an email from a couple in, I think they're in Idaho. They have kids. They divorced. Somebody had an affair. I don't know the details. But independently, they were each given a copy of this book. And after they read the book, they got back together and remarried. And now they have a completely different sort of relationship. But it's just because people find the book gives them an opportunity to talk about things that they've been afraid to bring up. And that's a wonderful thing for us to see.
And I want to give our listeners a chance to talk as well. John is on the line in Oakland. Welcome.
Hi. Sounds like a fascinating book, Mr. Ryan. You know, at the beginning of the hour, you were talking about sort of the pre-agricultural cultural context that this kind of promiscuity evolved in, and then the discussion sort of shifted off to people, I think, trying to wedge the notion of this promiscuity into a more of a current day context. But could you talk a little bit more about the culture in which, I mean, I'm assuming it's like communitarian groups, relatively small, where everybody's sharing everything, in which this arose?
Sure. Anthropologists describe these societies as fiercely egalitarian. And you find this fierce egalitarianism characterizing hunter-gatherer societies all over the world, from the Australian outback to Eskimos to the Amazon basin and so on. And so when you see something like this that's a universal trait of hunter-gatherer societies, you can be pretty sure that it also characterized the societies in which our ancestors lived before agriculture. And the reason for this fierce egalitarianism isn't that these people are noble savages. We're not making this Rousseauian argument. What we're saying is that, and what anthropologists say, is that the reason for fierce egalitarianism is that it's simply a more efficient way for hunter-gatherers to live than any other possible system. It's a way of spreading risk. So, you know, what we call a standard narrative, the story everyone's heard, which is that men have always traded goods and services, whether it be meat, status, protection, you know, so on, shelter, to a particular woman in exchange for her sexual fidelity. And the reason this exchange is at the heart of male-female interaction is that men are obsessed with their own paternity because they don't want to, you know, they want to make sure they are feeding and, you know, taking care of their own kids. That seems to make perfect sense to us in the modern world. But when you look at the way hunter-gatherers live, that's really a non-issue. There's no way a man is going to go out, you know, shoot an antelope, bring it back, and only share that meat with his mate and their children. That would get you kicked out of the society in a heartbeat. And the only way you're going to survive is to stay in that social group. So once we understand that very essential fact that these hunter-gatherer groups are fiercely egalitarianism, and it spreads into all sorts of interesting parts of life, for example, politics. You know, we're talking about corrupt politicians. The one thing you can do that will immediately disqualify you from a position of leadership in one of these groups is express any interest in being a leader. Right. So it's the opposite of the modern world where you've got to have the fire in the belly and you've got to be willing to, you know, be on the phone all day generating funds to support your campaign. Exactly. In those societies, you're a leader because people respect you, because people want to hear what you have to say and you tend to be right. So it's a very different approach to life materially, politically, emotionally, and sexually.
John, does that respond to your question?
I wondered just a follow-up, if you see any examples of this fierce egalitarianism in the, quote, modern Western world today. I mean, are people doing this?
Sure. You know, Occupy Oakland, Occupy Wall Street, what they're demanding is that resources be shared. They're demanding that the rights of the less powerful be respected. And this is something that we see as a fundamental value of pre-agricultural societies, and therefore, I believe, a fundamental value expressed in human nature. So, yeah, you can see this conflict between the two ways of life being played out in all sorts of dimensions of the modern world.
All right, John, thanks for the call. Let's go now to, to Ann in Pacifica. Welcome. Ann, are you there? Kevin in Oakland. Let's go to you now.
Hey, thanks for the show.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, I'm curious about the evolutionary perspective looking forward. I mean, there must be some way to extrapolate from trends from 10,000 years ago to now what direction we're going. And, well, if you have an opinion about which will win, or if there needs to be a winner versus monogamy and non-monogamy.
Christopher?
Well, I'm much more hesitant talking about the future than the past, I have to say. Even the present is a little confusing, but it certainly seems that the trend is toward tolerance, and it seems to be moving in that direction all over the world, and in the United States it seems to be moving at a rapidly accelerating pace. So I think what we're seeing is not that monogamy is going to fade out of the picture, because it is very much tied into a property-based economic system that we're going to have for the foreseeable future. But I do think that we're going to see much more tolerance for alternative family configurations, for different arrangements. Collaborative consumption is something that's taking off in a big way. And depending upon how this economic crisis plays out, we might see people finding innovative ways of saving money, helping raise each other's kids. You know, you could find, say, four or five different women buying one of these McMansions that's for sale, you know, and raising their children together. It would make a lot of sense in many different levels, and that would reflect in many ways what we're talking about in the book.
All right. Thanks for the call. Again, the number to dial this morning if you want to join us, 866-733-6786. We've got an email from Charlie who writes, I'm a divorce mediator and a lawyer in San Francisco. From my historical observations, primarily in the lesbian and gay community, what is important is that couples have an agreed rule. But he's talking about the rules, and the actual rule is irrelevant, but there be rules. Not in our bed, never kissing, only on business trips, never a second time with the same person, not to express anger against your spouse, etc. What seems to matter is knowing when the rule is being broken. And then he goes on to say, doesn't Dan Savage also say that non-monogamy is what keeps couples together long term? What are your thoughts about that, having explicit rules that, you know, place some limits around an open relationship?
Yeah, I think most successful couples who venture into these areas have pretty clearly articulated understanding of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And of course, there's no set rule as to that, you know, that all couples would apply. It's up to the couple to work things out, and those rules, of course, can change over time. But I think the point is that there are things agreed to beforehand, and and that the primary relationship is respected.
And to work out those rules mutually.
Exactly.
What about the gay community? The writer there, Charlie, refers to the gay and lesbian community. You know, are there different rules for same-sex couples, do you think?
Certainly the male homosexual community is way ahead of the heterosexual community in terms of the sort of flexibility in long-term relationships. And that is something that Dan Savage talks about, and I think it's something that the heterosexual community can learn from the gay and lesbian community to have a more to understand that the reason the glue holding together the primary relationship really isn't sex. You know, sex brings us together, but the role of sex in human society is to bring people together. It's to form bonds. It's to bridge distance, to bridge a gap. But once that gap is bridged, sexual passion naturally starts to diminish. And this is something that couples blame themselves for. And this is, you know, something, as I mentioned earlier, you know, if the sexual passion starts to fade a bit in a monogamous marriage over time, people often blame each other or they think there's something wrong with their relationship.
They go to counseling.
Yeah, they go to counseling, you know, okay, throw some rose petals on your bed or do it in the kitchen or whatever the advice is. But the fact is that's the sort of animal we are. We are attracted to erotic novelty. And I won't go into all the evidence for that, but it should be probably pretty obvious to most people. I saw a couple in a hotel in Australia a few weeks ago, and they were sitting in the lobby, and an attractive woman walked by. And it was amazing to see the man pretend not to notice the woman.
As he was looking out the side of his...
Yeah, of course. And the wife pretending not to notice that the man was pretending not to notice. And it just turned into this whole, you know, dance of denial.
So where does the whole don't ask, don't tell philosophy fit into all this? I mean, like you said, you know, we in America, we tend to have this culture of revelation and everything. Do you have a sense of, based on the data? I know you're not advising people, but, you know, is it better to, you know, where do you draw the line about disclosure?
That's not up to me. Casilda is a clinician. She's a psychiatrist. I'm a research psychologist. We talked, there was quite a bit of encouragement, let's say, from publishers to make this a sort of a self-help book. You know, they wanted 7 steps to eternal happiness. And we refused to do that. Every person is a world and a constantly changing world. And when you get two people together, it becomes a universe. And, you know, we just don't feel that you can give anyone relevant advice, especially people you haven't met. So all we want to do is present the information and
the discussion going
and let them work it out for themselves. Exactly.
Here, another email. A woman writes, my husband and I are interested in an open relationship, but not sure. How do we get started? We have kids. Both are professional. We need some discreet couples who don't judge us as well as this shouldn't impact our social life, family and friends and so on. What advice do you have?
Come to the presentation tonight. If there are still tickets available, I think there are a few.
And again, that's happening at the Supper Club in San Francisco. And you can find out more information at clubexoticapresents.com.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a panel discussion.
I was joking with you in the break that I came to the bittersweet conclusion a few weeks ago that people often don't come to my presentations to hear me so much as to meet each other because they know it's going to be a group of intelligent, open-minded people. And, you know, not everyone who comes to these presentations is in this sort of lifestyle, but they're willing to think about it and they're willing to talk to other people and see how things work and don't work.
Beyond that, though, I mean, there must be, find anything on the internet now.
Sure, yeah. There are, you know, look up Google polyamory and you'll find all sorts of organizations in your local area. And, you know, polyamorous tend to be extremely non-judgmental, supportive. You know, it's not – people come to these sorts of meetings or join these organizations, go to their meetings, thinking there's some sort of sleazy sort of sexual thing going on. What you actually find is an extremely high degree of respect for one another's rights, and nothing happens without explicit permission and so on.
Another email from Mark in San Francisco. He writes, if men and women have equally non-monogamous natures, why are modern women significantly less willing than men to have casual sex?
Huh.
Are they?
Well, 10,000 years of death penalty, you know, for a woman who defies her husband or her father, ends up, you know, on the streets. Still, in many parts of the world, they're buried to their necks and stoned to death.
Well, there's different biology, too.
There is different biology, and women, the research indicates that women are more responsive to social pressures, as I said earlier, in terms of their sexual behavior. As I also said, when you look at societies in which women are not slut-shamed, they're not persecuted for their sexual liberty, you find that they're as expressive and as interested in multiple lovers as men are.
All right, back to the phones now. Anne is on the line in Pacifica. Welcome.
Hi. I wanted more discussion of the problem of children. It seems to me that the biggest obstacle to polyamory is not Hollywood or organized religion, but the fact that children need more resources now in a post-industrial world than even in the agricultural era, when a lot of children left, left school much earlier and started working, let alone the hunter-gatherers. There wasn't even an issue there. So, you know, families where, you know, a huge chunk of the resources come from individual parents rather than society as a whole, that is, for children. And the children whose parents don't or won't or can't commit resources to them will be at this big disadvantage compared to those parents who commit to, these are my children, here are the resources and time and all this I'm going to give to them, as compared to people who can't get a stable mate, whose mate leaves them for someone more younger, more attractive. And believe me, current child support laws and alimony and all that are just grossly inadequate to make up for those kind of economic and social inequities that certain families, certain children, and certain women will end up, you know, facing. We just can't suddenly abolish private property.
Christopher Ryan, certainly, part of the point is that, you know, there are consequences to decisions we make.
Sure, not only on the personal level, but on the political level. When you look at Scandinavian countries, for example, where there's much higher level of support for women and children, public support, you find lower rates of marriage and lower rates of divorce among those couples who do marry.
And what about the health status of children?
Much higher. The United States is ranked 35th or something in the world in terms of infant mortality and overall child health. Not to even get into the dietary disaster in the United States in terms of children, the obesity and so on. The caller's right that all of this ties into how children are cared for. So when you find societies in which there's a group responsibility for children, whether we're talking about modern Scandinavian countries or ancient, you know, hunter-gatherer societies, you find more freedom in terms of sexuality. Whereas when you look at a society like the United States, that's very much private property-based, very low on the communal responsibility for one another, you find people much more tied into this sort of restrictive marriage. But the problem is that when it doesn't work, as it often doesn't, because of this conflict with our biology, you end up with single parents. And as the caller says, that's a nightmare. And
right.
It's very unnatural for our species.
Anne, thanks for the call. We've had a number of comments on the web from people saying that STDs, sexually transmitted disease, is a problem, and that monogamy is a good argument for that. What's your reaction to that? I mean, obviously you can protect yourself to a certain extent, but not entirely.
Well, or you can entirely. I mean, there are ways of having sex that that don't transmit diseases. And, you know, people in non-traditional marriages don't necessarily have more sex with other people than people in traditional marriages who are lying. And as we find in terms of sex education, if you look at the states that have sex education, there are lower levels of teen pregnancy, lower levels of sexually transmitted diseases. So there's something very healthful about putting this stuff out on the table and discussing it, because when you take away the shame, then you take away a lot of the shameful behavior in terms of unprotected sex.
Well, and perhaps if something is forbidden, you want to do it more. And if it's
that,
if it's an option, then yeah, maybe it's not as appealing.
Right. And I mean, I think to me it's very interesting. You know, we look at someone, a politician, I won't name names, but you know, someone who's been married three times and lied to every one of his wives and, was having an affair with each, you know, future wife while he was still married to the last wife.
And then ran for president.
And then ran for president on the Republican ticket and name rhymes with.
No, don't go there.
Anyway, a person like that holds himself up as a moral paragon. Whereas, you know, he would condemn someone who's having, an open marriage and has two other long-term lovers and everything's on the table and everyone are friends and they go out to dinner. And how is that morally superior, you know? And which of those situations you've got, you know, broken families, a stream of broken families behind you. It's amazing to me that that's considered morally superior.
Let's go back to the phones. Tracy in San Francisco, welcome.
Thank you for your program. It's fascinating. I wanted to ask your guests specifically about the fantasy or fetish aspect of one spouse who really enjoys seeing another spouse with somebody else.
Hmm. Yeah, cuckold fantasies are quite common, much more than would be predicted by the standard narrative, which says that men are obsessed with their paternity. So the last thing you would want to see is another man with your mate, right? But in fact, the cuckold fetish is very prominent, as any sex therapist will tell you. And, also in terms of the most popular forms of pornography, there's an awful lot of that sort of visualization going on, which again completely contradicts the standard narrative of human sexual evolution.
Thanks for the call, Tracy. You mentioned pornography, as you did at the top. It is so prevalent. I mean, it's always been prevalent, but now it's really easily accessible with the web and rental movies and online videos and everything else. What does all of that, the consumption of it, the profitability of it, what is it? How does it fit into this conversation?
Yeah, well, sometimes people say, after hearing me give a talk, they say, you make us sound like animals, you know, all this sex. The fact is animals have sex very infrequently compared to human beings. If you're 40 years or over, 40 years old or more, and you think about how many times you've had sex in your life and divide it by the number of children you've had, you're probably going to come up with a ratio of 1,000 to 1 or greater. A female gorilla has sex 10 to 12 times for each baby gorilla she has. It's very unusual for a species to have sex when the female is not ovulating. And, human beings, we have sex, as I said earlier, in ways that can't possibly lead to conception. We have sex when the woman's postmenopausal, when she's menstruating, and so on. That's very vanishingly rare in the animal kingdom. And what you find is that it's limited to species that are highly social, highly intelligent. Humans, chimps, bonobos, dolphins. That's pretty much it.
So dolphins and chimps suffer when we're compared to them?
Exactly. They're embarrassed. Yeah.
All right. Let's see if we can sneak another call or two in. Eric in San Francisco, welcome. Eric, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. Go ahead.
Yes, thanks for a very interesting subject. The courage to come out there and talk about this is great. I'm a single man. I'm 55 years old. I've never been married my whole life, and it's because I've always been, I guess, scared like some other people to do the full commitment because I didn't find it something natural. And I look around and married friends, and they're going through all kinds of trauma at this point. They get away from their wives, and the first thing they want to do is go to strip clubs and check out other women. And I'm looking at myself and saying, I can't do this because if I want to do marriage, it's supposed to be something monogamous forever, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, Eric,
I agree.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up a bit there. So I don't know if you want to really quickly make a final point or ask a question.
Yes, my question is, I like to be with a woman for about 6 months to 2 years, and I'm kind of jealous in the meantime if she goes out with somebody else. The subject of jealousy never did come up here. Is there something
Okay, I think we got the point, I think. Jealousy, we talked about it. There are a lot of human emotions around this.
Sure, sure. In the book we talk about, there's a chapter on jealousy, and essentially what we say is that in as much as jealousy is an expression of insecurity and fear of losing something that's important, it's part of human nature. But different societies can either diminish that fear, in a non-zero-sum, non-limited resources sort of context where there's an assumption of plentitude, where there's plenty of food to go around, there's plenty of sexual pleasure and companionship and intimacy to go around. Or we can have rituals that maximize that fear. And we have songs like When a Man Loves a Woman. You know, think about the words to that song. He'll spend his very last dime. He'll turn his back on his best friend, and he'll sleep out in the rain if she tells him to. I mean, what is going on there? Is that really love?
You know, we're just running out of time, but I wanted to see if you think there's a distinction that's important here between physical fidelity or monogamy and emotional fidelity, and is that part of the equation here?
Yeah, that's often a very important issue that couples will talk about. You know, we were talking earlier about the rules that couples will negotiate in these matters. And that's generally one of the first rules that'll come up in those discussions. You know, to what extent are we making ourselves emotionally available to other people as opposed to occasionally sexually available? And that's one of the big distinctions between what we might call the swinging community and the polyamorous community. Swingers generally are only having casual sex with other couples, whereas polyamorous are looking for more intimate relationships with other people.
Just a few seconds left. What do you hope comes out of this book and the discussions that it's generating?
We're loving the emails we're getting from people. We're loving the fact that it's moving the conversation forward, that the book is serving as a trigger for conversations that lead people to greater intimacy and authenticity and self-knowledge. And that's plenty for us.
And a reminder that you can hear Christopher Ryan tonight. He'll be part of a panel at the Supper Club in San Francisco. You can find out more about it if you visit clubexoticapresents.com. Christopher Ryan, thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, it's been an honor. Thank you.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Amy Machado. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thanks also to our listeners and all of you who sent your comments in. And during both hours, we can't do it without you, and we appreciate your being part of the show today. I'm Scott Schaefer, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.